Iraqi police have arrested a suspected al-Qaeda operative and claimed to have foiled what could have been a major terrorist attack during the World Cup, scheduled to be held at South Africa from June 11th on. He apparently is an ex-officer of the Army of Saudi Arabia, had been wanted on charges of perpetrating several terror attacks inside Iraq and abroad. And in just a moment, Ryan Morrow will talk about this and a number of other international affairs in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Ryan Morrow is the founder of WorldThreats.com, the national security advisor to the Christian Action Network, and an intelligence analyst with the Asymmetric Warfare and Intelligence Center. And Ryan has been published in WorldNetDaily.com, Newsmax.com, and WorldTribune.com, just to name a few. He's been on the program before, he'll be on again, and he's on now. Ryan, how are you? Good morning.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
You too. Hey, let me get your reaction to this Iraqi story before we get into some of these other issues. Trying to break up, apparently, another al-Qaeda-type attack at the World Cup, which will be on June 11th. Is that a major story for them?
I think it is. There have been various arrests, actually, for plots related to the World Cup. So we've been dealing with this for actually years. So al-Qaeda and the various terrorist organizations have been looking at this event to make a splash for a while. There was a radical Islamic forum, internet forum, that al-Qaeda members have used in the past that issued a threat against the World Cup a few months ago, and the South African authorities kind of blew it off and said that there was nothing to it. But then we found out that all the various Western media outlets were being told by intelligence officials on our side that it actually was credible, and additional security and training was being provided to handle it.
Ryan, when we last talked, which was almost 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, we were looking at terrorism. Where do we stand today with terrorism?
I think state sponsorship is playing a larger and larger role. Terrorist groups are becoming more and more dependent upon countries like Iran and safe harbors in Pakistan and Syria because al-Qaeda has been basically thrown out of Afghanistan, although they're making a comeback there. So that's where we stand right now. I do think that we're being extremely effective, though. Over the past year, we've seen that radicalization of American Muslims has increased. There's been growing homegrown terrorist plots, and the Obama administration has actually concluded privately that radicalization here at home is increasing. But at the same time, notice that a lot of these plots are failing, that they're being carried out by amateurs. It appears that al-Qaeda and a lot of the more aggressive terrorist organizations are suffering from a lack of expertise and a lack of people to provide proper training, which is actually a good thing.
That is a good thing. What's going on with the search for Osama bin Laden?
Well, remarkably, there's actually more eyewitness testimony, more direct testimony that Osama bin Laden is in Iran than in Pakistan. If you look up all the accounts, it's actually much larger, much larger amount are placing them in Iran.
That's growing, isn't it?
Yes, it is growing. For example, there was a smuggler that has actually claimed to have met with bin Laden about six times since 2003 to October 2007. Now you say, why should we trust a smuggler who makes a living off of lying? Falconry.
Good question.
Yeah, I asked it for you. Falconry is where you send out the falcon, they go and they get to pray for you. It's kind of a status symbol of all the elites in the Arab world and Central Asia. And that's how al-Qaeda made a lot of their connections with their financiers, and bin Laden loves to do it. And being the playboy that he is, we shouldn't be surprised that he'd still want to engage in that. Now, we shouldn't just trust the words of this smuggler that was involved in this trade. But what happened was that Ken Timmerman, a really hotshot journalist, was told about this smuggler claiming to have this information on bin Laden. And on a certain date in 2006, they received information that bin Laden was moving from a safe house in Tehran to where the hunting grounds take place. And his intelligence sources confirmed to him. They said, yes, we are picking up chatter inside Iran of someone extremely important moving from that exact location to the falconry hunting grounds, and they've shut off the fields to all the foreign guests, even the really rich and powerful ones. So that was some pretty powerful substantiation. We also know from one of bin Laden's sons that up to 40 members of the bin Laden family are living a very nice life in Tehran.
So he's living the life of Riley. Of course, you were too young during that TV show, Ryan. I'm not sure you were even born then during the life of Riley. So basically, he's living like a little king?
That's exactly right. We know for a fact that his family is living in a massive compound where they have a swimming pool, PlayStations, Xboxes, computer access. It's really quite the nice life. And what the Iranians seem to do is that it appears that they're holding his family hostage as a way of keeping bin Laden silent as he travels around. It's possible he still travels to Pakistan, although that seems pretty risky. It appears that Iran is actually holding his family hostage as a way of controlling the terrorist leader.
Really? Now, this is fascinating. I mean, is he being held hostage as well, and do they follow him wherever he goes? Have they basically captured him?
Well, they've had long ties together. So when bin Laden had to flee there in the summer of 2002, and the Pakistani army launched an offensive in where he was hiding in Pakistan, he went to Iran. In a way, they are kind of capturing him, even though he chose to originally go there. But they now basically control him. All the reports that I looked at, I put together a timeline so I could figure out exactly where he is at what location. All of the accounts I got matched and corroborated each other, even though the sources are separate, and they all said that every step of the way, he's being guarded by members of the elite Revolutionary Guards.
Now, that's fascinating. We went into Afghanistan to find bin Laden. We didn't find him. We didn't do the job there. If we think he's in Iran, why don't we finish it up?
Well, it seems that both the Bush administrations and the Obama administrations are not willing to go that far to engage in essentially, it would be an act of war. I mean, it would be a violent snatch operation on Iranian soil. And then at the same time, I believe that you have people inside the intelligence community and the State Department that are still sticking to this very naive belief that extremist Shiites would never work with extremist Sunnis, and therefore the information simply can't be credible. And so they ask for unrealistically high standards of evidence in order for them to change that view. So I think that's really the issue there. In 2006, there was actually a snatch operation put together by some people that are engaged in the effort to fight falconry because they smuggle falcons. It's pretty brutal to the bird. And they had former special operations operatives ready to go in there and get them based on the information of this smuggler. And they were told by the FBI that if they continued to plan this operation, they would be arrested.
Why?
I think that we're scared to set off a war with Iran. You know, the government doesn't like private people going off and doing the job that they should be doing, especially something like this.
No, even though I think the future of wars will be mercenaries, paid mercenaries.
I completely agree. I think that we're moving more and more in a privatized direction. I think private companies are able to do a lot more than what the government's able to do.
Can you imagine a publicly held company that deals with employees who are soldiers? They pay them, and they get contracts from governments to go in and have wars. They could be Americans, but they wear really no flag, and they have honor to none. They just go wherever they're told to, and they're paid to do it.
Right. I think in the West, though, you're going to see a lot more regulation over that, especially considering there's been some really nasty incidents with Blackwater in Iraq. So those contracts dealing with private contractors are being brought under an umbrella. So I do think that you're going to see a lot of regulation over this. But I do think you're going to see a greater role for private military contractors, even in the intelligence world.
What are the odds that the bin Laden is in Iran?
Very high. I mean, all the information really seems to point there. It's just people don't want to see it. I mean, the common logic is that he's in Pakistan. I mean, it doesn't ruffle any feathers for people to say that. It doesn't challenge anyone's views. And indeed, maybe he actually does go there at times. But if you were to create a chart of the eyewitness accounts and the reports of him in Pakistan saying specifically he was here on this certain date at this certain location in Pakistan, and then you do the same with Iran, the Iran list is a lot longer.
Do you think the drones have him spotted?
I wouldn't be surprised if they don't, actually, just because the Iranians are very, very good at what they do, and they're very aware of where he is. But you raise a very good point about the drones. I mean, the area of Afghanistan and Pakistan, that's probably the most watched area in
yes.
the world.
Yeah.
And if he is in Pakistan, he'd have to be constantly moving around, and we would be able to detect the movement of foreign Arabs, even through sources on the ground there. I mean, they stick out.
Ryan, do we really even want to capture him?
I think that we do. Well, I think we definitely want to kill him. I think that for policymakers, they're probably a little queasy about the idea of capturing him, because then do you put him in Guantanamo Bay? Do you put him in a civilian trial? But I do think that if it's convenient, yes, we'll go after him. But it depends on the risk. And, you know, the story about Iran really shows that the administrations, both the Bush and Obama administrations, weren't telling the truth. And they said that they were going to do absolutely everything in their power to get him.
You know what I would do? I would just let him loose on the streets of New York. And, of course, I would let every New Yorker know that they were going to let him go at this time and have him run for it.
And
justice
would
be done.
That's why we're never going to be elected.
No, but justice would be. I don't know. With that kind of attitude, we could get elected.
Maybe what we need. I think people are fed up.
Yeah, they are, and we'll have to see what happens. But if he is in Iran, to me, that's grounds for something. I just hope he would be in Iran, so they don't use it as an excuse. You know what I mean?
Who would use it as an excuse?
Anybody would want to go in and attack Iran.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. You know, yeah. If there were no weapons of mass destruction, look what happened. I wanted to, you know, if you go to Iran and say, we're going in there because bin Laden's there, not that we would, because we would have by now, but let's hope he is in there.
Yeah, sure. I see what you're saying. You have to worry about it playing into the hands of people that kind of want to wage war everywhere.
Yep. And they're out there.
Yeah, there are people out there that are like that. And, you know, the thing I would say is that it is without a doubt known that there's a massive al-Qaeda network there, that there's managers there, that bin Laden's sons have been there. And the Treasury Department, if you look at the list of the people that they've blacklisted and whose assets they've been freezing, I mean, you're talking about major, major al-Qaeda figures operating out of that country. One person alone oversees a network of 100 Saudis operating out of that country. So even if you take the bin Laden element out of it, that alliance with al-Qaeda is scary enough to warrant action.
Did bin Laden basically buy his way into Iran? How did that all happen?
Actually, no. They've had an alliance going back to around 1993, actually. Sudan played a very pivotal role in breaking down the wall between extremist Shiites and extremist Sunnis, saying that, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and we can settle our differences later. Right now, it is our duty, it is actually Allah's will for us to unite against the foreigners and the non-Muslim world, especially the United States and Israel. And starting from 1993 on, or even before that, but I would say around 1993, 1992 is when it really started going, that's when you saw all those ideological barriers being broken, whether it be with Iraq and al-Qaeda or Iran and al-Qaeda or even the various rogue nations that previously been at war with each other. They all started working together in one way or another, of course, keeping a watchful eye on each other at the same time.
Give me a round robin of what's going on in the Middle East. If you want to pop in and tell me about Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, Afghanistan, just give me a round robin of what's happening out there.
You're actually seeing a very unique alliance form, albeit unofficial, between the Sunni Arab world and Israel against Iran. Most Arabs, I would say, are actually more scared of Iran than even Israel is. And that's because their regimes are very fragile.
Yes.
But what the Iranians are trying to do is, aside from actually getting a nuclear weapon, they are trying to fundamentally change the shape of the Islamic world and the balance of power in the Middle East through using proxy forces. We've been seeing this in Iraq, we're seeing it in Afghanistan, but they actually waged a proxy war with shipping arms and personnel in Yemen over the past year. And they had radical Shiite militants physically fighting a major war against the governments of Yemen and Saudi Arabia. It was a major conflict. And so what the Iranians are trying to do is they're using Shiite minorities, which conveniently for them are located near the major oil reserves in the Arabian Peninsula, to launch uprisings against the Arab governments. They're not fully going for it just yet, but they're sending the message, you better fall in line, otherwise we have the potential to rip these oil fields away from you.
It's going to be an interesting couple months, I think, isn't it? Maybe even year.
I think so. A lot of people are worried about the summer right now. Apparently there's been satellite photos taken of an Iranian ship that's docked in Syria delivering weapons to Hezbollah. We already know that Scud missiles have been transferred to Hezbollah, but apparently whatever was being taken out of this submarine, the people were wearing chemical warfare suits. So there's a major concern right now that actual chemical weapons are being transferred to Lebanon.
So what do you think is going to happen? What's your gut tell you?
It's hard to tell. It'll come. I don't think Israel's going to launch the first strike, like a lot of people are saying, into Lebanon this summer. I don't think they're even going to launch a strike this year. But here's really the big scenario. This is the game plan that Iran is pursuing, aside from the proxy war. Under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran can put together basically everything that they need for a nuclear weapon, but they're not going after a nuclear weapon. They're going after a nuclear arsenal. They're building a massive infrastructure so that almost overnight they can, bam, have a nuclear arsenal. They're not going just for one bomb and then potentially using it. They want the whole
shebang,
thing.
Shebang, yeah.
Yeah. And under the treaty, they're building up their capabilities as much as that they possibly can. And then, actually, under the treaty, you're allowed to build nuclear weapons as long as you announce that you're doing it 90 days from when you leave the treaty, citing a legitimate security concern. So the Iranians will find a pretext. Or they might even provoke an Israeli strike on their facilities. So in that regard, it's quite possible that the Iranian regime wants Israel to bomb some of their nuclear facilities because it leaves the regime intact. And it gives them the excuse that they need in the eyes of the international community to leave the treaty and say, in 90 days, we're building a nuclear weapon. We didn't want one, but now we need one.
Don't most Iranians want this regime tossed out anyway?
Absolutely. The vast majority of Iranians want the regime just completely destroyed.
The religious zealots, all of them, want them all out. They want to be able to take their veils off and be westernized.
Absolutely. Most people don't know that only half of the Iranian population is what you would consider Persian. The rest are minorities that are basically completely cut out and disenfranchised with the government. And so they're immediately opposed to government. And then, as we saw last summer, the majority of the half of the population that is Persian also hates the regime. So you're looking at a minimum of 80% of the people that very, very much dislike the regime and would love to see it gone.
Well, I know a lot of Jewish people who were born in Iran. They were
Isn't that
born
amazing?
In Iran. Yeah.
Yeah, there's actually a pretty vibrant Jewish community there. I mean, they're persecuted and they're not enjoying life so much right there. But the average Iranian really doesn't have a problem with Jews.
No. Or Americans.
No, they very much
or Americans.
Love
those days of the 70s when they took over the embassy, they're gone. With most, it's almost the other way around.
Our best ally at one point.
Yep, absolutely. What's taken Israel so long, Ryan? I would have figured by now they would have done something.
Well, they've.
There's a bigger picture here.
Yeah, they're worried about playing into Iran's hands because the Iranian leadership believes that they are working in an end times period. And that it is their duty to create the conditions for this person called the Mahdi, which is their messianic figure, to come to earth and vanquish all of their enemies. And so Israel's worried that if they provoke a conflict, then that will, or if they launch a strike on Iran, then Iran will see that as the unfolding of prophecy and launch a major war and hit them with everything that they've got. And they've got major assets. We're not talking about Saddam Hussein or Al-Qaeda. We're talking about something far above that. But the reason that Israel hasn't bombed them yet is because Iran's nuclear program has been delayed a lot by covert programs. Israel has had cyber warfare on Iranian computers. They actually have had the ability to remotely destroy, set off explosions in Iran's nuclear program. Some scientists have gone missing. Some have died. There have been major defections. And most interestingly, the CIA and Mossad and probably some other Western intelligence agencies were active on the black market selling defective equipment to Iran that has really destroyed and damaged a lot of their centrifuges. And Iran would have a nuclear weapon by now if these covert programs weren't launched.
Ryan, we're going to come back and take some phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And on our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to be talking about genetic roulette with Jeffrey Smith. And when we come back, we'll take phone calls, your calls, with Ryan Morrow on Coast to Coast AM. Half hour to go, we're with Ryan Morrow. Ryan, what's new with the WorldThreats.com group?
Well, we're doing what we always do, where we keep track of all the news that's going on that we feel deserves more attention. But perhaps more interesting to some to your listeners would be the work I'm doing at the Christian Action Network. We put out a film last year called Homegrown Jihad that caused quite a stir about how there are actual terrorist camps on United States soil, and we visit them in our film Homegrown Jihad, which is available at christianaction.org.
When you say you visit them, were you invited to or did you sneak in?
Well, we went up to the doorstep, and they really wouldn't let us in. I personally visited a place that you're familiar with called Islamburg in New York State, which is the group's headquarters. Mm-hmm. It's 70 acres large. And these places are used not only to indoctrinate their followers into radical Islam, but to give them paramilitary training, which we have caught on videotape.
Now, are they doing anything illegal at this point?
Some members do, and when they do and law enforcement finds out about it, they do arrest them. But the problem is that so much of this activity happens on the inside of these massive compounds that are dozens of acres large, and the authorities don't have the power to just go in and raid these places and search everything. So who knows what else is going on inside there. But I've been given videotape that we put out on YouTube by a law enforcement source that showed paramilitary training going on inside these places. So we know it's happening.
Huh. I'm sure they're spying on them from above, aren't they? Us?
I'm sure they are. I mean, the authorities know, a lot of them know that this is a bad group, that's a radical group, and a lot of them have expressed their frustration to us. Their leader, though, is actually based in Pakistan. He's a man named Sheikh Jalani, and believes radically anti-Semitic things. You know, the type of thinking that says the United States government is controlled by the Zionist Jews that are responsible for all the evils in the world. So even if people don't believe that they're a terrorist group because they have these nice outreach programs with government officials and the communities, what they're teaching these people is horrible.
Where'd they get their money to buy all this property? It's expensive out there.
Right. Well, it must have come in from overseas because Sheikh Jalani, who's in Pakistan, has quite a network over there, and he originally established the first compounds. But from then on, a lot of this is actually owned by members of that group, and they work as toll booth operators. Some of them even own security companies, which absolutely blew my mind. Some people are school bus drivers, and they donate the majority of their income to Sheikh Jalani. It goes back to Pakistan.
Amazing. All right, to the phones we go. Let's go to Dyersburg, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hey, Philip, go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Ryan.
Good.
Hi. I have a question. Novelist Brad Thor announced on his website about 2 or 3 days ago that they had actually captured Mullah Omar in Afghanistan, and it's been confirmed by 3 different sources, including a group called the Black Five. And I was wondering if this is true. And the national media hasn't been reporting it, and the government hasn't said anything. Are they keeping it quiet because they don't know what to do with him? Because they didn't kill him, they captured him. Do they don't want to read him as riots or have the headache of it, or what's going on?
It's actually a great question. I have no confirmation that that's true. I very much doubt that report because I don't think that he would be in Afghanistan. All the reporting places him either in Karachi, Pakistan, or far more likely a place called Quetta in the province of Balochistan. That's an area where the Taliban leadership resides, and the Pakistanis have turned a blind eye, if not directly supported them. But, I mean, you raise an important question. When we capture these guys, what do we do with them? And that raises the point that I've been making over and over again, that the Obama administration has basically the same policy as the Bush administration, except they're a lot more clever about how they go about explaining it. The Obama administration has kept Guantanamo Bay open despite their promises to close it, and they have at least 50 detainees there that they're still deciding to hold without a trial.
All right, then, I'm reading this report by Brad Thor, where he says his sources say that Mullah Omar has been taken into custody, but we'll have to find out. There was a bounty up to $10 million on his head. We'll see.
Yeah, I haven't received any verification of that on my end.
No. Okay. Let's go to Dallas, Texas. Keith, it's your turn. Hi, Keith.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Look, I think that the Russians, at least on some level and in some ways, are pulling the strings in the Middle East still, especially with respect to Iran. I think if the Russians want there to be a war, there will eventually be a war. But if they don't want a war right now, there won't be one. They have a lot of investments in Iran. They have a lot to lose there. And, but at the same time, though, I think that if something did go down between Israel and Iran, I think the Russians would be ready to rearm the Iranians and make up for whatever losses the Iranians would suffer in a bombing from Israel or the United States, for that matter.
Now, another great point. The Russians, I don't think that they actually control things in the Middle East, but I mean, the intelligence services of Syria and Iran have received a lot of training over the years from the Russians. Their ties to these countries go a long time, and they view them as geopolitical outposts. The Russians are hard at work, along with the Chinese and the other rogue nations, building an unofficial alliance of rogue states to change the balance of power in the world. They're constantly talking about the need for a multipolar world, and what that means is building up the power with absolutely anybody in order to challenge the might of the United States. And economically, your caller pointed to a very important point, is that Russia makes a lot of money off of arms sales. So they need a certain level of conflict in the Middle East in order to keep that going. So if Iran's arms are destroyed, they need to be replenished. The Russians see dollar signs. And in addition, the low oil prices is really hurting them. So they, from time to time, need a major crisis to keep oil prices high.
Apparently, the source for Brad Thor is Oliver North. So you might want to check into that and see if it's real or not, Brian.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I'll have to check into that. I'd be very surprised if he was captured in Afghanistan.
No, actually, the article says Pakistan, so
it does.
The caller was wrong. So that makes more sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, that does make a lot more sense. I don't have the article in front of me. Does it say where in Pakistan?
Karachi.
Really?
Yeah. On March 27th, according to Oliver North, he was arrested on March 27th.
March 27th. You know what? That could make sense, actually, because Mullah Baradar, the number two man of the Taliban, was captured around that time or shortly thereafter. And I wrote at that time, I said, this man knows where Mullah Omar is. And so they're going to be hot on his trail if they didn't capture him already. So that actually lends a lot more credibility to that report. But it hasn't made its way around the Internet enough for me to receive it just yet.
I'm sure he knows where bin Laden is, huh?
Yeah, I think he definitely does. There had been reports that bin Laden was actually staying in his general location in Balochistan in Pakistan whenever he visited that country.
Interesting. Okay. Next up, we go to Dennis in St. Louis, Missouri, east of the Rockies. Hey, Dennis, go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
My question is that are our troops over there more or less in an occupational mode, or is it an actual war? Because I get confused about the two.
Well, that's a good question, Ryan.
Mm-hmm. I would say it's counterinsurgency mode, which is a little bit of each. For a long time, the U.S. soldiers, I would say in Iraq, if I were to use that as an example, were in occupation mode because there was no elected Iraqi government, and that's why they were viewed as occupiers, because we didn't want to say it, but that's what they were at that time. They are that no longer. But a counterinsurgency model combines war fighting, where you have to go in and secure a population, and then it enters into a nation-building effort where you have to build the civil institutions so once you leave, the country can hold together and you can give the tools necessary for the population and the host government to fight the insurgents. So and counterinsurgency campaigns are long, they're costly. It's really the hardest type of conflict to fight, but we are winning. And unfortunately, every war we fight from now on is going to have to be fought on this model.
Gosh, I hope not, Ryan.
Well, that's why we've got to try and stay away as much as we can from, land invasions now. This is how it's always going to work. Governments are fragile, but then what they do is they disperse among the population, and they've learned from the terrorists, they've learned from the Iraqi insurgents, that the best way to do things right now is guerrilla warfare, and then you go to other governments that hate the United States for supplies, arms, and logistical support.
Are you seeing any attempt for us to get out of Iraq at this point?
I do think that our troop levels are going to drop to 50,000, but how much further they go below that, I don't know. I think we're going to be playing
Will this still be, we're going to close down Guantanamo and it's still operating?
Oh, yeah, it's going to be that way. It's pretty obvious what we're going to do right now. We're talking about how the troops that are left are going to be basically renamed as advisors, but they're going to still have guns. I mean, if they're soldiers in a foreign land, they're going to have the ability to defend themselves.
Yeah.
and the administration is talking about them only engaging in quote-unquote counterterrorism duties, you know, back up the Iraqi government with airstrikes, special operations when they're needed. That's the exact same thing that we're doing now. The only difference is the chain of command. The Iraqis call them in. And so I think that you'll see casualties dramatically drop because the Iraqis are a lot stronger. But fundamentally, that's not really much of a change.
Let's go west of the Rockies. It's James in San Francisco. Hey, James, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for letting me on. I wanted to ask your caller. I was very interested when he was saying Bin Laden may be in Iran, and a lot of people have said so.
Mm-hmm.
Is what I didn't quite understand. I thought he had like a $50 million price on his head. So what's to stop a group of 5 to 10 ex-U.S. High-level people from just going in themselves and snatching him?
Or taking him out.
Mm-hmm. Or taking him out and videotaping it, or, you know, some way to prove it. And you know, whereas the American government may not want to go into Iran like we did with Carter, you know, and actually land planes in the desert. But some group of mercenaries, just to get the $50 million and to be on the cover of Time magazine.
I would guess, Ryan, he's pretty well protected or surrounded.
He's very well protected by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. But at the same time, like I said, these people that got in touch with this smuggler, they were ready to go in and snatch Bin Laden back in 2006, and the FBI told them, if you continue planning this, we're going to arrest you. And I know the people that were involved in this, so I know that they're serious people, serious contacts. And I believe that if they had done it, they would have been successful because the smuggler provided them with the shortwave radio frequencies of the radios that Bin Laden was putting on the backs of the Falcon.
Oh, my.
And and from that, they believe they could have located Bin Laden within a square mile.
Mark in Denver, Colorado, you're up on the wild card line. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I was just curious as to what Ryan would have to say. I mean, we've seen several videos and tapes that could possibly be fakes. Obviously, you never really know. I was questioning the fact that Greg Pallas from BBC had interviewed Benazir Bhutto, and she had claimed he had died. And within months, obviously, we know.
So did she.
She met her demise, yes.
Yeah, she did say that.
Yeah.
Was that a slip of the tongue, Ryan, or what?
I'm sorry?
Was that a slip of the tongue or what? Then she said he was dead.
See, the press didn't do a good job of following up, but generally the attitude taken when I talk about those people in the intelligence community is that they think that she just misspoke at the time. But at the same time, the Pakistanis have been trying to say he's dead because it really suits their interests. But in regards to the audio tapes, here's an interesting point. Notice that it's audio tapes and not videotapes. Now, former Iranian intelligence officers who have provided credible, actionable intelligence that have saved American lives in Afghanistan have described how they saw Bin Laden at high-level meetings in Iran with Revolutionary Guard protecting him. And they said that he actually was dressed like an Iranian cleric, he had trimmed his beard, and that he had, at this one meeting in 2003, he had an IV out of his right hand. Now, if he's changed his appearance because he's in Iran to look like a Shiite cleric, then that explains why he doesn't want a videotape out there.
I wonder if he got a kidney transplant. You know, had a weak kidney.
Yeah, the general consensus intelligence community is that he never needed that, that he's not on dialysis, that he might have had kidney stones, but that was a myth that also came out of Pakistan, probably to make him appear weaker than he really is.
Let's go to Miles driving around in Indiana, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Miles.
Yes, I have a question about the drug wars going on in Mexico right now. Is that considered terrorist acts since it's spilling over into the United States now?
How would you look at that, Ryan?
I wouldn't say it's terrorist, but I mean, I would call it guerrilla warfare at this point. And it's something that terrorists can and actually are taking advantage of. They're taking advantage of that open border quite immensely. But what's going on in Mexico is extremely scary. You have drug gangs that actually have seized entire towns, and they actually run them. And over 20,000 people have died in Mexico. More people have died in Mexico as a result of this war last year than all of our casualties of all the years of fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq combined. But nobody's paying attention to it. It's amazing to me.
Don't forget, though, we still have about 25,000 homicides in the United States every year. That sounds like an internal war, doesn't it? Let's go to east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
So, this is Roger Corman calling from St. Mary's, West Virginia.
Go ahead there, Roger Corman.
Corman, C-O-R-B-I-N.
All right.
What do you want here?
Well, you tell me. You called.
Okay. I'm calling to discuss the Bible prophecy of the Old Testament that has to do with the Middle East. This war has never been fought yet. And it has to do with the Israelites in Iran and United States and England getting into a nuclear war.
Well, many people have said that. Nostradamus predicts that as well. I don't know if you get into prophecy at all, Ryan, but you know what? You never know.
I don't, but I'll tell you, as a Christian, as someone who really likes to analyze things, it's amazing to me how accurate the Bible is time and time again.
Absolutely. So tell me, how did y'all get involved in this at a young age?
I was hired when I was 16 years old. I was basically obsessed with national security topics a few years prior. It just set off something with me, so I studied a lot. And then it was just one of those, I guess you could call it chance encounters, even though I don't believe in chance, with someone that was making a maritime security company at my school. And then at age 16, he hired me to start doing analysis and research for him as a geopolitical analyst. And then it from there, just opened a door after another door after another door. And it was a few years after that I actually came on your show. And I started attending really high-level national security summits. And it was your listeners that helped make that happen, because I didn't have any money to do that. And I actually had people that listen to your show emailing me saying, look, here's a little bit here, here's a little bit there. We're going to make this happen for you.
And here you are. How old are you now, Ryan?
I'm 23.
Gosh, you're so old now. Ryan, let's see what happens in the next 6 months. I think it's going to be an interesting roller coaster ride.
Yeah, I think so, too. So feel free to call me up whenever you need.
Absolutely. It's Ryan Morrow. Websites, worldthreats.com. Linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. So take advantage of that. We've got a great week of programs for you on Coast to Coast, including shows that affect your health, shows that affect your senses, shows that affect your mind, and also shows that will just make you wonder, is that real? For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.